Anyone who's ever preached realizes the most difficult thing is deciding what to preach on. And I remember a great many years ago, an elder giving me some advice as a very young guy who's starting to make talks. He said, talk about something that you know a lot about, something you're familiar with, something you experienced. That's what you really should preach on. So I'd like to talk to you about childish behavior, something I know a lot about. Very good to have you with us. We appreciate your presence here and hope all the things we have to say are consistent with God's Word and might edify and encourage you as you strive to live the way God would have us to live. To begin with, we think about the subject of childish behavior. Proverbs chapter 22 and in verse 15 says, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction shall drive it far from him. 3 points I think we need to start with. Number one, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child. I believe what the proverb writer is suggesting to us is that this is normal and natural for a child to be foolish, for them to act up, for them to need some guidance, some restriction, some direction in their life. They really don't know what they're doing and where they're headed without us. We mentioned in Bible class this morning one of the traits of children are they're selfish. We all started off that way, and except maybe Mary Nell. We all started off that way, and as we behaved that way, our parents guided us from being selfish into being what we ought to be in life. So children have this foolishness, this selfish, mischievous nature within them, and that's perfectly normal. But we also recognize it's not desirable. It is something that should be driven from them. We don't see anything wrong when there's a one-year-old who's sucking on a pacifier, but when a guy's 13 years old and doing that, we feel like there's something wrong here. Now, that behavior should have been driven out of his life. There should have been some maturing that took place, but he behaves differently than what he did once before. So our child starts off being foolish. We want to drive that from them, and the tool that is used to drive that foolishness away is the rod of correction, which is a figurative term. It does not literally mean a rod necessarily, but any sort of discipline or chastening, which could include spanking, should be used to drive this foolishness away from the child. Now the problem is, the child's behavior is there, the kid is naturally engaged in it, and the parent very often excuses it. We've known parents who said things, well, you can't stop them, all kids are doing it. And so their kid is giving a pass to keep on acting foolish as they go from 3 years old to 10 years old to 12 years old to 16 years old. They're allowed to keep their foolishness never driven from them as their parents make excuses for them. Proverbs 19 verse 18 says, chasten thy son while there is hope, and let not thy soul spare for his crying. The crying tells us that this is not something that's pleasant for the kid. If you don't know what chastening means, recognize at least it's something the kid does not like. It's something that will produce crying in him. And that is the discipline. But we need to chasten our son while there is hope, telling us that there's a time when we've run out of opportunities. That window was shut and now we no longer have the ability to control them, to change the way that they're headed. And so when the foolishness is in the child is engaged in this behavior, sometimes the parents will excuse it, and many times the peers will incite it. Those other kids that are foolish, the wrong crowd as we like to refer to them, the bad guys, they get a hold of our child and encourage him to do bad things. And the reason they have such power over him is because the greatest fear is rejection for that child. Not fitting in. That's the most important thing to him. He wants to belong. And so he gets among these peers that are encouraging him to do bad things, and he wants to fit in with them, and so he does the bad things that they encourage. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, many of you could quote, be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners. Our child may have some goodness about him, but those peers will corrupt that completely if we don't step in and stop making excuses for them and start disciplining them the way they ought to go. Now, the parents will excuse the behavior. The peers will incite the behavior. But what we recognize is that it's the person who ignites. The individual who is doing the wrong behavior is going to be condemned. And we're condemned individually. You see, I don't show up at the gates of judgment and say, you know, my parents failed me in many ways, so I think I ought to be able to go into heaven. Or my peers encouraged me to get in this behavior, so I think I ought to go to heaven. It's really their fault. No, I'm judged as an individual. And the fact that the foolishness that was in me as a child was not driven out by my parents, it was encouraged by my peers, really doesn't make any difference when it comes down to my being judged. Proverbs 20, verse 11 says, even a child is known by his doings, whether his work be pure and whether it be right. And so at a very young age, a child can be educated, can be instructed, and a child can start doing the right thing and start establishing a character and a reputation of being a good person. In Psalm chapter 127, we have actually two Psalms, 127 and 128, that kind of join together, discussing what we might consider to be a history of life. It starts off with building the house and again ends up with having grandchildren all around your feet. But we're just going to read the first few verses of Psalm 127 at this point. It says there, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. It is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, and to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep. What it's telling us here is that God is in charge of things. And if I want to be a success, and if I want things to go well, I can't worry about it, and sit up late and ponder it, and plan it, and scheme it, and invest in it, and all these other things. I've got to do what God says. It's the Lord that builds the house. It's the Lord that makes it successful. And I've got to submit to His will in all things in regard to my family as well as everything else to make it successful. Verse 3 says, lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward. This tells us that children are a blessing that comes from God. And even though there's foolishness in there, even though they're a little bratty sometimes, even though they kind of wear us out sometimes, we need to remember that they are blessings from the Lord and help them to appreciate that they are appreciated. They need to know that we're crazy about them, that there's something special. And we feel so grateful and so loved by God giving us those children. They need to be made to feel that way. What I really want to focus on, though, is verse 4. And 5, which says, as arrows are in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed, but they shall speak with the enemies in the gate. A comparison is made then of children to arrows. And a parent that has his quiver full of arrows or his house full of children is somebody who has really been blessed by God. But three things we want to establish in regard to arrows that relate to children that I think maybe the psalmist is trying to get at. And if not, they're applicable anyway, and so it's worth our time. Number one, parent needs to aim. You need to take your arrow and you need to aim it at what it is you're wanting to hit. That arrow is not going to go where it's supposed to go if you don't take careful aim. And so there needs to be a goal in the parent's mind of, I want my child to be thus and so. I want my child to arrive at this destination. The parent needs to take aim. You know, there are some parents that never consider their children's future. The children are born and they kind of raise themselves and the parent says, well, he'll grow out of this trait and he'll find some friends someday and someday some good girl will marry him and kind of help him along, you know. And the parents do absolutely nothing in regard to taking aim of where I want my child to be. From the time your child is born, your goal should be, this child is going to become a Christian. He's going to be faithful to the Lord Jesus Christ. I am going to give him the instruction and the guidance and the example. I'm going to be taking him to worship service. I'm going to see that he does his Bible classes. This child is going to be a Christian. That needs to be what we are doing with our child, taking careful aim with them. But so many parents do not. In Proverbs 22 and verse 6, it says, train up a child in the way he should go. That is, there's a direction he ought to be going, and you are aiming at that direction. That's, you're training him in accordance to the way he ought to be going, which I believe refers to following God. And when he is old, he will not depart from it. And realize proverbs are truisms. There are exceptions, but generally speaking, if you aim your child in the direction he ought to go, he's going to stay with that all throughout his life. Proverbs 23, verses 13 and 14. Withhold not correction from the child, for if thou beatest him with a rod, he shall not die. Again, the idea that he will not die is an indication that it's a hurtful thing. He's not going to enjoy being spanked. He's not going to enjoy being disciplined. And a lot of kids are going to act like they're going to die. I remember kids who just, as the parent gets ready to spank them like they're just going to lose their life or something. And it's not anything like that. The parents aren't going to really hurt that child in any permanent way. It's something that's going to sting for a little bit maybe, but the child needs this in order to straighten his life out. So you don't withhold the correction from the child. When you beat him with the rod, he's not going to die from that beating. He goes on to say, thou shalt beat him with the rod and shall deliver his soul from hell, which means the grave. Where is your child aiming at right now? He's aiming for death. What are you going to do? Well, my child's going to raise himself. He's going to make his own decision. No, you're going to bring him up and you're going to aim him in the direction he ought to be going. You're going to point him to where it is he needs to be going. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning at verse 4, we hear what Jesus refers to as the greatest commandment. It says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. And thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy might. As God is one, so our dedication to him needs to be one. It needs to be singular. He needs to be the one and only God in our life. And we love him with all of our being. And then he goes on to say in verse 6, and these words which I command thee this day shall be in thine heart. What words? To love the Lord thy God with all your heart and with all your soul. They're supposed to be in your heart. These are the words that ought to be paramount in your thinking. It's what you're thinking about all the time. You're not thinking about football scores or baseball scores or who's winning the basketball playoffs. You're not thinking of what this guy's releasing in his new hit single or what this movie this guy's going to be in. What you're thinking about all the time is the Lord. And as you're thinking about him all the time, you're able to relate what you're thinking about to your children. Verse 7, and thou shalt teach them diligently unto thy children. Notice he said diligently. And shalt talk of them when thou sittest in thy house, and when thou walkest by the way, and when thou liest down, and when thou risest up. How many of us count on the Bible class here at the church building for the sole teaching of our child in religious matters? No hands go up. Good. You shouldn't. You should say, oh yeah, Bible class take care of that. No, sir. You have that responsibility. You need to teach your child all about God and instruct him in the way they ought to go. The Bible class is merely a supplement. We have your child for less than 2 hours in a Bible class. He gets more than that on math and on English and on history and everything else in public school. But we only get him for 2 hours. Less than that because of the time going in and out of the class and so on. And we're not going to be able to instruct him in all these things that he needs. But because your heart is filled with the Lord and totally dedicated to him and you think about him all the time, when you're sitting with your child, God comes into the conversation. When you're walking with him, by the way, God comes into the discussion. You bring him up when you're laying down. When you're getting up, God just keeps on coming into the conversation all the time. I remember my wife telling me one time as our children had chicken pots and they had spots all over them, and Caroline was about 3 years old at the time, and she said, look at all my spots, Mom. Didn't God do a good job? Well, they thought about God all the time because we talked about God all the time. And that needs to be what goes on in all of our homes, that God is paramount in our discussion. He goes on to say in verse 8, and thou shalt bind them for a sign upon thine hand, and they shall be as frontlets between thine eyes, and thou shalt write them upon the post of thy house and on thy gates. They would wear leather patches with pockets in it. Within those pockets, they would put scripture, sometimes on the forehead, sometimes on the wrist. And then they'd have these little cavities within their house by their porch, and they could put scriptures within those cavities. Have you ever seen Ben-Hur? There's an example of one of those when he comes to his home. But all of these things saying, I'm going to have the scripture all over my house. I'm going to put it on my bathroom mirror. I'm going to put it with a magnet on my refrigerator. And I'm going to wear a bracelet that talks about what would Jesus do, maybe. Or I'm going to have a cross on my neck. And I don't think there's anything wrong with having those things. But more important than having them on your person is having it in your heart and having it in your mind and having it in your conversation.
But what he's saying here is this is going to dominate your whole existence. You're going to think about a God all the time, share it with your children all the time, have it on what you wear, have it on your house. It is going to be part of who you are. And that's how we aim our children in the direction they ought to go. You know, there's some kids, they grow up and all they think about is being a football star. And that's because that's all Dad cares about. He just loves football. He watches it all the time and he sweats all the time it's not on and keeps talking to his kid about who catches the ball and who makes the best plays. And the kid thinks, the only way I'll ever please Dad if I make it in the NFL. And he grows up with that idea in mind. Dad has aimed him in a direction that is the wrong direction. Not that there's anything wrong with the sport, but it should not be the ultimate thing in your life. But a second thing about arrows is you need to let them go. You know, if you take that arrow and you aim it and you hold it forever, it's never going to hit its target. You're going to have to let go of it at some point. Lamentations 3:27 says, "It is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth." While we are young, it is good for responsibilities and burdens to be placed upon us so that we can understand what it is we're supposed to be doing in life and what it is all about. Childhood should not be all about having fun. We read in, as early as in the book of Genesis that there's a time that's going to come when a man is supposed to leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife. We've got to let him go. We got to let go of that bowstring and let our child fly in the direction that he's been aimed at. And very often that's going to be in marrying somebody who's godly like he is and seeking the principles that ought to be had. We're going to have to let go of them. And when we let go of them, we want them to be the right kind of person that's going to go where they need to go and do the things they need to do. A lot of parents don't like to let go of their children. You've probably known parents like that. That they marry somebody else and mom is always over the house with talking bad about the wife that married into the family and coddling her son all the time and telling the wife how she needs to do better for her son and on it goes. And the in-laws just won't get out of the way. And you need to do that. You need to let go of them. You've aimed them in the right direction. Now you've got to let go and let them fly where it is they need to go. Now Joseph was the favorite son of Jacob. But Jacob couldn't hang on to him. He had to let go. It wasn't his decision. His brothers took him and sold him as a slave. Came back and told their father that some wild animal, well, they didn't say some animal killed him. They gave him the coat that was covered with all kinds of blood and let him draw his own conclusions. And he said, some wild animal must have killed my son Joseph. He had to let go of him. Joseph was gone out of his life and would be many years before he would come across him again. But this favorite son moves from being the apple of his father's eye to being a slave in Egypt. Or what about the Jewish maid? Here's a child who's living at home and everything seems to be fine, and all of a sudden there's a Syrian raid, and people are taken captive, and this little Jewish girl is taken captive and given to Naaman's wife to be her servant. And so she goes from being a happy youngster playing at home with her parents, perhaps, to being some sort of slave in some foreigner's household. Wasn't anything her parents had anticipated. They didn't plan on that. They didn't want it to happen. But they had to let go of her. She was gone out of their life. Or Daniel, a man who was royalty. He's of the lineage of the kings and the special family. They were all conquered and taken captive and made to stand within Babylonian captivity and the courts of the Chaldeans. Daniel didn't plan on that happening. His parents weren't wanting to let him go at that time, but they had to. That's something that happens. And it happens to all of us. We're going to have to let go of our children. Now, of the three of these, recognize they're all away from home in a strange environment. One's in Syria, one's in Egypt, one's in Babylon, and none of them grew up in those situations. They're all in some strange place they've never been before. How do we act when we find ourselves in a strange place with nobody that knows us, and everybody that's there has a different culture and a different behavior than what we grew up with? How do we behave when we get in that situation? Not only that, they were all without the influence of their parents or spiritual leaders at the point they got separated from them. This Syrian child didn't get to bring mom and dad with her into Naaman's house. Well, I got to ask my parents if it's all right for me to do thus and so. No. She's by herself now. They all lost their parents or the leaders and the influence that they would provide for them. They were all forced into their situation through violence. Joseph thrown into a pit and then eventually sold into slavery. The girl taken in a Syrian raid. Daniel taken because Jerusalem had been conquered. Violence brought them all to the place they were at. But none of these things had any effect on them. Being without their parents, having been brought there by violence, being in an environment totally unfamiliar to them, didn't make any difference because they all knew God and followed His will. And where do you think they learned that? Could it be that parents who loved the Lord their God with all their heart, with all their soul, with all their mind, talked of God when they were sitting down, when they were standing up, when they were walking by the way, and these three young people learned to respect God through that instruction? In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 22, Paul writes, "Flee also youthful lusts, but follow righteousness, faith, charity, peace, with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart." Because you're a young person, Timothy, does not mean you can follow youthful lust. You flee from them. You get away from them. All of these young people could have made their excuses. Well, you know, I'm in Babylon now, and you know what they say, when in Babylon, live as the Babylonians. You know, they could have made their excuses. Well, Mom and Dad weren't here to guide me, to tell me, and so I had to do what I had to do. You know, they could have made their excuses, but they didn't. This Jewish maid had enough faith to believe that Naaman's leprosy could be cured by the prophet that was in Samaria. Although her faith didn't profit her directly, she had enough faith that Elisha still could perform that miracle. And we read again and again, Joseph had God with him all through his experience until he got to be the prime minister of Egypt. God was still with him through all of that. But a third point in regard to our errors. You need to take aim. You need to let go. And the third point, you've got one chance. Once that arrow has been aimed and released, you can't say, "Oh, I didn't mean that," and go chase it down and catch it before it hits the target. No, you've got one chance. Once it's gone, it's gone. We're living in an age of great deal of technology, and many of you send emails one to another. And you know, when you're writing an email, you can say anything you want. You can say how you hate the person. You can say he's got ears like a donkey. You can say anything you want because you can erase it all. You can change it all. He'll never see it. You can obliterate that, delete that, erase that. But once you hit that send button, all of a sudden that arrow has been released, that email is gone, and you can't retrieve it. There is no undo for the email that you sent. As far as I understand, I'm not much of a computer person. But understand that then, that you've got to be careful about what it is you actually send out, because you only have one chance to send that, and once it's sent, it's gone. In Hebrews, the 12th chapter, verse 11, we read, "Now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous," and you can ask your child about that, they'll tell you that's true, "but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth a peaceable fruit of righteousness unto them which are exercised thereby." This passage is telling us that right now, at the present, the chastening is needed. It's not going to be pleasant for the child, but it is necessary. We've got to do it now while it is needed. It is no good to come to our child when they're 25 years old and say, "You know, when you were 5, I should have done this and that." That is not going to help them to get to where they need to be. When they are 5, you need to do what needs to be done in the chastening of them. You've got to do what needs to be done now so they will benefit later. You see, now is the only time you've got. You've got the arrow. You're letting go of it. That one chance, that's it. You've got to do it now. Because after they're out of the bowstring, they're gone, and you can't do anything more about it. You're only young once. If we turn our attention to the young person's behavior for just a moment, you're only young once. And you have one choice, what you're going to do with your life, where you're going to live, who you're going to marry, how you're going to behave. One choice. That's all you get. Because after that one choice is made, you're not young anymore. Now you're old. And now the choice is behind you, and you can't do anything more about it. In Ecclesiastes chapter 11 and verse 9, we read, "Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth." It's fine to have fun when you're young. "And let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine own heart, and in the sight of thine own eyes." Basically, he's saying, do what you want to do. Have a good time. "But know thou, that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Don't think because you're young and the things you're doing for fun are sinful that you're going to get away with it. It's not going to work. Do good things, fun things, enjoyable things, but do the things that aren't going to bring you into condemnation before God, because He's going to hold you accountable for that. Therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity. You can spend your youth doing wickedness, but you're not going to be able to get your youth back and do it another day, another time, differently. Whatever, however you spend it, that's how it's spent. He says in chapter 12, verse 1, remember now thy Creator in the days of thy youth. While you are young, focus on God. While the evil days come not, nor the years draw nigh, when thou shalt say, I have no pleasure in them. And if you read on further, I believe what he's talking about there is when you get old. When you're young and your body is strong and you can eat anything you want and it doesn't give you all kinds of problems within your body. And you can see well and you don't need glasses and you've got all kinds of energy. Well, then you go ahead and enjoy yourself at that time, because the time's coming when your body's going to get old, when it's going to be stiff, when you can't stay up as late as you used to, and all these other things are going to ravage you. And so have a good time while you're young, but don't have a good time sinning. Have a good time recognizing I can do a lot of things with this young body that I won't be able to do later. Enjoy that time. But remember, you only have the one choice. You only have the one youth that can be spent in one way or the other. I like the story of Ruth. Ruth chose to follow Naomi to Bethlehem. If you like to look at that text real quick, Ruth chapter 1. And you remember the story. Naomi was a mother, and she and her husband and two sons went to Moab because of a famine. While they were there, the two sons got married, one to Ruth, one to Orpah. And after they got married, all the men in the family died. And so now the famine is over, and Naomi is going to go back to Bethlehem, and Ruth wants to go with her. Now, Ruth has only one choice. She can't live in Moab and live in Bethlehem at the same time. They didn't have jet airplanes where she could skyrocket back and forth. She's going to have to do one or the other. She's only got one choice of where she's going to live and what she's going to do with that youth that she has. And while she's there and planning to go with her mother-in-law tries to discourage her, and Ruth won't have any of it. Chapter 1, verse 16 says, and Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee or to return from following after thee, for whither thou goest, I will go. And whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Where thou diest, will I die, there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. Often this is read in marriage ceremonies, as we're talking about the commitment between a husband and a wife, and it ought to be this. It ought to be such that we're going to go where they go and lodge where they lodge, and we're going to have nothing but death separating us. And I believe that phrase, till death do us part, probably comes from this very verse. As we recognize this is a commitment for life. And Ruth had that commitment to this mother-in-law. How many of us would do that? Give up everything that could be in our future for the sake of some elderly woman that we're going to look after. Well, that was her attitude. She gave up her homeland. And with the homeland, she gave up the family. Said goodbye to mom, dad, any brothers or sisters. She gave up her friends, the kids she went to school with, the people she worked beside. Had to say goodbye to all of them. She gave up everything that was familiar, the corner store and the farm next door and all the things that were familiar and helped her to know where she was and what life is all about. She's given up all those. And most importantly, she was giving up the future chance of having a husband and having children. And she knew all this and was going to follow her mother-in-law anyway. We can only make the one choice. And she chose, I am going to follow her and stand by her side. And it didn't make any difference that Naomi urged her to stay there in Moab. No, I'm going to go with you. It didn't make any difference that her sister-in-law, Orpah, after Naomi's urging, decided, well, okay, I'll go back to my people, and she went back. Ruth still wasn't going to leave. She was still hanging on to her mother-in-law. And it didn't make any difference that the logical arguments that this older woman brought up made a lot of sense. She said, now look, Ruth, if you're going to wait until I find another husband, and then have another son, and then that son grows up, you're going to wait a long time, and we don't know that any of those things are going to happen. If you're going to have a husband and be able to have children like all of the women in that time would like to have, you're going to have to stay here in Moab.
And Ruth said, no, I'm going with you, and don't try to get me to stay. Now, of course, God worked it out that she did get a husband, and she did get a child, and she's in the lineage of Jesus Christ. But she didn't know any of these things were happening, and she was ready to sacrifice them all, realizing that my mother-in-law needs me. I think an important message made for all of us there. But the point I'm trying to emphasize is we've got one chance, one choice. She can't live two places at the same time. She's going to have to make a decision. And her decision was to help out Naomi, and for that, God blessed her. And so as parents, we get one shot to aim our children toward God, and then we have to let them go. And we hope they will stay true to the course that we aimed them at and keep on following God and being faithful to Him till they leave this world. Children are young only one time, and it quickly vanishes away. And if you're going to spend that youth causing all kinds of chaos and trouble, you're going to look back on your youth with great regret and wonder, why was I so stupid? Why did I do all of those things? You'll be disappointed. You see, we exchange our time for experiences. There's only one thing you can be doing at a time, only one thing you can be focusing on at a time. I received a phone call not too terrible long ago, a few weeks or months maybe, from a guy I went to high school with. And he says, is this Ron Roberts? And I said, yes. Is you the Ron Roberts who went to Bradley Bobonas Community High School? That's a mouthful. And I said, yes, I am. And he said, well, Ron, I'm glad I found you. This is Bill. And I said, well, what can I do for you? He says, our 40th class reunion is coming up. Want to know if you'd like to come. 40th? 40 years ago, I graduated from high school? I'm 57 now. I graduated 70. Yeah, that computes. What have I exchanged for all of those years of existence? I've got a wonderful wife. I've got two wonderful daughters that are faithful to the Lord. They've got two wonderful husbands who are Christians. I think I made some good exchanges along the way. But as we look at that, we think, all of my life has been burned up. And what have I got to show for it? What have I exchanged for it? We need to ask ourselves that. Will we regret the trade that we made? What would we think? I really shouldn't have done this. Let me tell you something. There are no refunds. You can't say, I don't like the way I spent May 25th, 1975. Well, okay, here, have another one. You don't get it. However you spent that time, it is gone now, and whatever experiences you gained from that time is all you get. You can't go back and redo it. Will we regret what we've traded our time for? And will others follow us? And this is one of the things that really bothers us. We recognize sometimes that I lived foolishly and I wasted my time and I shouldn't have done that, but I've grown out of it and now I'm a Christian. But what about all those people that were around at the time I was doing those things? Those people who were never going to be Christians because of our example, because they were friends of us. Or they value us as being a hypocrite because they knew what we used to be and can't believe that we really changed. Will others follow us? And the most important question, of course, will you reach heaven? Will you reach heaven by the way you spend your time, by the things you do with your youth, with your age, with your choices? Will heaven be yours when this life ends? And that's the most important thing. If you missed heaven, you missed it all. And it does not matter how much money you gained, how many fans you have, how much fame you possess, how wonderful your family is, or how big your mansion is. It makes no difference. If you miss heaven, you've wasted the life that God has given you. God put us here that we might serve Him, live a life that is proper, guide others in the way they should go, submit to His truth in all points. That's why we're here. Are we spending our time doing that? If you're not a Christian this evening, we pray that you'll consider becoming one. You need to hear, believe, repent, confess, and be baptized for the remission of your sins. That puts you in contact with the blood of Christ. That brings you into the church. And once you are in the church, a synonym for being a Christian, then you need to live your life faithfully in service to God from that day forward. The foolishness that was part of your childhood needs to be driven out of you as you live faithfully for God as a righteous and responsible person from the day you obey the gospel until the day you die. If you have fallen from God's way, if you have deserted His cause, you can come back this very evening. We would encourage you to do so while we stand and while we sing the song that's been selected.